Why you gotta hesitate when you're gonna play that song and make my day? She said, play that song.
All right. Oh, my dog's going to take just this very moment to start barking. It may stop here pretty quick. Nice. Just when I'm going to start recording, they're going to start barking. Welcome back. Thursday, April 28th, 11:10 a.m. And we're going to pick it up where we left off. We were doing solvent effects. And I'm just going to remind you kind of where we were at. So I'm going to do a little overview here because there's one little part that I missed in the solvent effects that I want to pick up before I move on to the next topic. So when we were looking at solvent effects, we worked from this reaction. We worked from tertiary butyl bromide. And this was, I should also preface this, this is unimolecular. So what we're looking at here is we're looking at SN1, E1 type reactions in terms of unimolecular and the effect of solvation on these. In this case, we're looking at acetic acid, and this is an SN1 reaction in the replacement of that bromide with an acetic acid with an acetate group. And we did this last time, so I'm just re-showing kind of what we did. And what I had written out was the solvent, different solvents that we used. And I put that dielectric constant in there for each solvent. And we looked at acetic acid, which had a dielectric constant of 6. We looked at methanol that had a dielectric constant of 33. Formic acid, which was 58. And then finally water, which was 78. And out of these, we did that relative rate where we divided each of the rates by the acetic acid rate. So acetic acid had a rate of 1. Methanol was 4 times faster. The formic acid was 5,000 times faster. And the water was 150,000 times faster in terms of its rate. And what we said there, that this really had to do with the formation, and this was an SN1 reaction that we were looking at, this really had to do with the formation of the carbocation. And that when we took a look at that formation of that carbocation as a first step in these unimolecular reactions, and we go from the bromide to the carbocation, that anything that can decrease the energy of this carbocation, anything that can bring this down, will also affect the transition state and will bring the energy of the transition state down. And that's linked by Hammond postulate. And so what that does is that affects the activation energy. And if you can decrease the activation energy, then you can make the reaction run faster. So decrease in energy of the transition state reduces E sub A and speeds the reaction up. So just going back to that transition state then, if I draw that transition state, what we're really saying is that in that transition state for this molecule, that my transition state is polar. And because the transition state is polar, it's highly highly affected by solvent. And that what we find is that higher dielectric constants, let me put the word in there, higher dielectric constant solvents . So that's a high dielectric constant solvent, will strongly solvate and stabilize. Solvate, there we go. And stabilize the transition state. And so that's what we see going on here, is that the more polar the solvent, so we have an increasing polarity, that the more polar the solvent, the better the solvent is able to solvate and stabilize the transition state, thereby lowering its activation energy and making the reaction go faster. What I didn't say is, how does that translate into the bimolecular reactions? So when we go and we look at bimolecular reactions, so that's what we covered last time. What about these bimolecular reactions? When we look at bimolecular reactions, what we're looking at is the SN2, where we have the transition state. I can do it this way, where we have a nucleophile coming in, bonding to the carbon, some sort of leaving group, partial minus, and then that carbon is in a temporary sort of pentavalent state. That's the transition state there. And our E2 reactions, where we have a proton that is being pulled anti-periplanar to a leaving group. So we're creating a double bond there. That's also being pulled by the base. The base has a partial minus, the leaving group a partial minus. And then we're transitioning to a trigonal planar orientation about that developing double bond. My dogs are gonna freak out. We have somebody cutting the grass next door and they just hate the lawnmower. Both of these transition states, when we look at them, are very similar to a molecule which has polar components, but that those polar components cancel each other out. So something like carbon dioxide, where it's partial minus, and this is nonpolar. These transition states, the SN2 transition state and the E2 transition state, are similarly nonpolar. Okay, and so we might think that what we need is a nonpolar solvent, and that a nonpolar solvent would then accelerate these reactions by stabilizing these transition states. And in reality, that's true to a small degree, but it is not substantially true. In other words, because these transition states are nonpolar, they don't have a large buildup of charge in them. And because there's not a large buildup of charge, there's not a whole lot to stabilize. So what we find is that these transition states, these bimolecular nonpolar transition states, are not heavily affected by solvent. So we'll say that they're not strongly affected by solvent. So what does that really mean? What it means is that nonpolar solvents will make these reactions run faster. SN2E2 reactions faster. But a polar solvent will not shut them down. So while they may run faster in a nonpolar solvent, a polar solvent won't really shut these reactions down. That differs in that when I look at the unimolecular, we have to put my dogs in a different spot so that they're not so barking. Unimolecular reactions, these are polar transition states. These are strongly affected by solvent. So here what we're saying is that they run faster in polar solvents. And the other caveat of this is they shut down in nonpolar solvents. And the reason that they shut down in nonpolar solvents is that carbocations are not solvated by nonpolar solvents. So there's the big difference, is that when we're looking at SN2 and E2, that they are affected a small amount, but not strongly. Whereas the unimolecular ones really are strongly affected by solvent. So there's the big difference in those. And the part that I had covered, you know, I had covered the this part, the SN1, E1 component, and we kicked that one around really well, but we didn't talk about the bimolecular. So I wanted to come back and I wanted to hit that really quick. Okay, so moving on, this is also solvent and we're looking at solvent effects here. So we'll keep going with solvent effects, but this is solvent effects and how they affect stereochemical effects. So solvent on stereochemistry. And here we're going to look at SN1. Let's take a reaction. We will use a molecule that has a stereocenter in it. So let's use a benzyl chloride. And I'll put a methyl group on it in addition. This is an S configuration in stereocenter. We're going to look at a sulfolysis reaction where we are going to have replacement by water. In order to have this reaction run, it needs a little bit of acetone for the solubility of the substrate and of the products that are coming out of this. So this is a sulfolysis, meaning that this is an SN1. And we get two different products that come out of this chemical reaction. We get a product where the hydroxyl group replaces the chlorine on exactly the same side that the chlorine came off from. And we get a product where the hydroxyl replaces from the opposite side. And I'll draw that one by bringing in the hydroxyl group from above and inverting the stereocenter. So let's say that I'm looking at the chlorine, and let's call the chlorine, this is an S stereocenter. This is where the hydroxyl group replaces it directly, or where the hydroxyl group is coming from the opposite side. We'll give names to these products. This one we'll call a retention product, meaning that the stereocenter is retained, retention. This is an S product. And the other one is what we call the inversion product. This one is where the stereocenter is inverted and has become an R. When we look at the ratios of solvents, we look at the ratio of water to acetone. And we can change the ratio of the water and the acetone that are in this mixture. We can look at 100% water, 0% acetone. We can look at 40% water and 60% acetone, or 20% water and 80% acetone. And what we see is that the product ratios change depending upon the ratio of the acetone and water. When it is 100% water, we see 41% of the product is the retention product, and 59% is the inversion. As we add acetone into this reaction mixture, and now we go to 40% water, 60% acetone, the ratios change to 43% and 53%, excuse me, 47 and 53. When we go to 20-80, it becomes 49% and 51%. So what are these numbers telling us? Well, clearly what's happening is there was some asymmetry in the reaction initially when it was all done in just water, 41% to 59%. I didn't get a 50-50 mixture. Normally what we would expect is that when I have a reaction like this that is going through sulfolysis and it's going through a carbocation, I would have equal approach from the top and the bottom of the water. And so what I'm expecting is that in the reaction, when I form the transition state, or not the transition state, but the intermediate, and I'm actually going to draw this, I'm going to draw it this way. Here's my carbon. Here's my methyl group. There's my hydrogen. This is the carbocation and the empty p orbital of the carbocation. And we can put the benzene ring in here too. Try to draw that a little bit more flat. So there's the benzene ring. This is representing the carbocation. The water that is approaching this is approaching a flat sp2 hybridized carbon, and it can come from the top, or that water could come from the bottom. And there's equal approach above and below. So with equal approach above and below, I might expect or should expect a 50-50% outcome.
So how would we be able to structurally predict like the ratio of it coming from above and below?
Well, what we expect there is that when the stereocenter is flat, trigonal planar, and there is no other steric constraints that are blocking the top or blocking the bottom, then we expect a 50-50 outcome. But what we're seeing is that depending upon the solvent ratio, we're not getting that 50-50 outcome. What's happening is as we're going down and we're looking at the data, we are getting closer to 50-50. The question is, why didn't it start out 50-50 when it was just water? Why, when it was just water, was I so asymmetric with retention being a lower percentage than inversion? And that's what becomes the question. So let's look at two different pictures here. Let's look at a picture where it's 100% water. In 100% water, what's happening is as that group is leaving, as the chloride is leaving, this is partial minus and partial positive. As the chloride is leaving, water molecules that are trying to come from the bottom, that are trying to do a retention product, are being blocked sterically by the chloride, which is leaving. The chloride itself is acting as a blocking group and getting in the way of water coming in and doing the retention product. However, water that is on the backside has a freer access. This is the inversion. We can say it's SN2-like in that it's coming from the backside. And there's less sterics there. It's more open. And so what we're seeing is we're seeing 59% versus 41%. And then it can really be explained by the sterics and what's called a tight ion pair. When the substrate and the leaving group form a tight ion pair, the retention side is somewhat blocked. And so when there's 100% water, there's a tight ion pair that is maintained, and the chloride becomes a blocking group, preventing the retention product. What happens when I go and I put in a lot of acetone and I'm at 20-80? So now I'm at 20% water, and I'm at 80% acetone. What happens here? In this case, what happens is there is not a whole lot of nucleophile in the solution. And being that there is less nucleophile in the solution, there is more time for the chloride to escape and get away, and more development of the carbocation. They do not form the tight ion pair. And so what I see is that there are a lot of acetone molecules that are sitting around that are supporting this. And all those acetone molecules are not acting as nucleophiles. They're simply solvent. And there's a lot of them. And they allow for the chloride to be able to dissociate away and break up that tight ion pair. And then the water molecules that are sitting in here, of which there are fewer water molecules, have more equal access from above and below. And so by reducing the amount of nucleophile and adding a non-nucleophilic solvent such as acetone, it allows for the tight ion pair to dissociate. And then we get closer to that 50-50 expectation. Right there at 20-80, we see 49 and 51%, much, much closer to the 50-50 that we expect in a solvent like this. So solvents can affect the chemical reaction by also limiting the development of the carbocation, the full development of the carbocation, and making a tight ion pair, depending upon what the solvent is actually doing. So we can see stereochemical outcomes as well. Just little things to think about as we go through and fine tune sort of what's happening in these chemical reactions and how solvent can affect the chemical reactions. All right. Let's switch from solvent And let's take a look at the nucleophile. So we're going to look at nucleophilicity, how nucleophilicity affects things. Here's a problem. When we start looking at nucleophiles, we can look at relative nucleophilicity. How good a nucleophile something is. When we look at relative nucleophilicity, what we see is that one of the best nucleophiles that we have is a sulfide anion, and that thing is a much better nucleophile than the cyanide ion. Cyanide is better than iodide. Iodide is better than hydroxide. Hydroxide is better than azide. Azide is better than bromide. This is just a long list of things that are better than other things. Just a relative nucleophilicity. It's a phenoxide. That is about equal to an acetate, which is better than a chloride. I mean, this list just keeps on going. This is better than a fluoride, which is better than a nitrate, which is better than water. And when I look at this list, there's no rhyme or reason to this list. The list is just a list. And there's no particular order or trend that is easy to see. No super clear trend in nucleophilicity. So how do I deal with that? Well, there are some trends that I can point at and I can look at within this list of nucleophiles. So the trends that when I look at all these nucleophiles and the trends that I see is one thing is nucleophilicity decreases with increasing electronegativity. Nucleophilicity decreases with increasing electronegativity. So if I take a look at the electronegativity trend, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, fluorine, and we're going in order of electronegativity and increasing electronegativity, then what I see here is that a carbon nucleophile, let's make it a carbanion. A carbanion is a better nucleophile than a nitrogen anion. Usually what we do is we put R groups on these. Makes it a little bit easier to see kind of what's going on. And that nitrogen anion is a slightly better nucleophile than an oxygen anion, which is a better nucleophile than a fluoride anion. So we can use the electronegativity trends to gain some idea. This is the best nucleophile. This is the worst in the set. But this is the most electronegative element. And this is the least electronegative. So there, in terms of looking at the electronegativity trend, what we're seeing is that elements that hold their electrons more tightly are worse nucleophiles. So that makes sense. If you're going to hold your electrons more tightly, then you're not going to be as nucleophilic. Another trend that we can see here is that if we look at hydroxide and water, that something, hydroxide and water are conjugates, that something that has an anion is a far better nucleophile than something which is neutral. So anions are more nucleophilic than their conjugates. So here we're looking at something like hydroxide is a much better nucleophile than water, than its conjugate. By the same token, we could say something such as acetate would be a far better nucleophile than acetic acid, than their conjugates. Or another one might be that R2 minus would be a much better nucleophile than R2NH, than the amine. So anions are much more nucleophilic than their conjugates. For protic solvents, nucleophilicity increases going down a group. Let's put it on a new page. For protic solvents, nucleophilicity increases going down a group. So what do we mean by that then? What we mean is that HS minus is a better nucleophile than OH minus. Or we could say that iodide is a better nucleophile than bromide, which is better than chloride, which is better than fluoride. All right, so what is it that happens when we go down a group? When we go down a group and we're looking at oxygen versus sulfur, or we're looking at fluoride, chloride, bromide, and iodide, that as we go down a group, what we're talking about is size. We're talking about something which is small versus something which is relatively large. Fluoride is small, chloride is a little bit bigger, bromide is bigger, iodide is even bigger. That this is about size. So why is it that something that is large is a better nucleophile than something that is small? Put it with a question mark, because this is counterintuitive. If it's large, large has more sterics. Why would something that is large be a better nucleophile than something that is small? That intuitively does not make sense until we bring a couple of things into here. Number one, let's say the solvent. And number two, something called polarizability. Not sure where I want to start, if I want to start solvent or if I want to start polarizability. Let's take the solvent idea first and look at the solvent idea first. If I'm looking at solvating fluoride, fluoride has a small charge density, or I should say high charge density. By having a high charge density, it's very unstable. And what happens is it needs a lot of solvation from whatever solvent is there in order to support it. It gets a tight solvent cage. By this tight solvent cage, you can think of this fluoride as being a caged anion. In other words, in order for it to act as a nucleophile, it needs to break out of the cage. And the cage is keeping it from acting as a nucleophile. In order for it to act as a nucleophile, it's got to get out of the cage, and it is blocked from getting out of the cage. Something that is a large anion, let's say iodide. Iodide has a low charge density and is much more stable. As a low charge density, this thing doesn't need as much solvent stabilization. And so while there is solvent molecules around it, they're not abstracting it or clinging to it super tightly. It has more flexibility and more ability to be able to get away from the solvent to be able to go through and to act as a nucleophile. So it's just less tightly solvated. It doesn't need the solvation that higher charge density anion needs. And that allows it to act as a better or stronger nucleophile. Now, the second thing that I said was the polarizability. So what is polarizability? Polarizability is a concept that something is soft, squishy, polarizable. What it means is that it can change shape. So that if I take something that is an iodide, that is a very large, soft anion, that thing can change its shape and its electron density, such that its electron density can sort of outreach. If I push the electron density out this direction, that I can change partial minus, partial positive, it is now polarized. And that can allow it to be able to get into some tighter spaces than would otherwise think it normally could. And so as a nucleophile, this thing is able to do backside attack and to get into tight spaces. It has an easier time attacking the substrate. Due to its ability to change shape. And so the combination of these two, the combination of the solvent and something that has a high charge density needing to be tightly solvated, and the combination of polarizability make it such that as I look at these solvents or as these nucleophiles that are going down a group, that we find that nucleophilicity increases as we go down the group. And those are the two competing factors that are there. So going back to the factors themselves, I'm trying to think if there's any factors that I haven't covered yet. I'm gonna go back and look at the temperature. We haven't really covered temperature yet. And we haven't really covered what is the difference between a base and a nucleophile. So we need to cover sort of those two things yet. Let me go back to the factors. Let me write down the factors again. The factors were substrate, We said that was of primary importance. We've already covered that. We've talked a lot about that. This is whether it's primary, secondary, tertiary, allylic, these different types of substrates that we can deal with, which is really talking about the position of the leaving group. That's what the substrate means. Then number two, we had two different factors that contributed that we said were of secondary importance. So I'll include these two factors. These both come in and fall sort of at the second category. This was the leaving group. And I haven't really discussed the leaving group much. We're going to talk a little bit more about that. The base and the nucleophile. We've started to talk about the nucleophile. So we've sort of done nucleophile, but we need to come in and talk about the base a little bit. Third, we said the solvent. So we've covered the solvent. And fourth, temperature. And we haven't covered temperature yet. So these are the different factors that we're hoping to cover. With leaving group, the leaving group is actually pretty easy. Let me pick up leaving group real quick, and then we'll come back and we'll target base and we'll target temperature. The leaving group is actually pretty easy. The better a leaving group, the faster the reaction. Basically, the way that I think about the leaving group is particularly with unimolecular reactions. I really think more about the leaving group than I do in SN2. So if we're thinking about SN1, E1, leaving group has bigger impact. What makes a good leaving group? A good leaving group is a weak base. So what are the qualities of a weak base?
High stability.
High stability. A weak base equals a very stable anion, or very stable, let's say just species overall. And all those factors of stability, electron withdrawing groups, resonance, all of those factors play into size, play into what makes a leaving group a better leaving group. So when we think about leaving group, generally iodides are better than chlorides, are better than bromides. Better than chlorides, better than fluorides. Fluoride is a horrible leaving group. Those things that are leaving as neutral species are more stable than those things that are leaving as anions. So if I look at a leaving group and my leaving group is water, and I could think about this as leaving as a cation, such that when it comes off, when it breaks off, it becomes water, versus a hydroxide coming off and leaving as OH minus, that the water molecule is a way better leaving group than something that is coming off as an anion. So how do I make even a better leaving group? Well, we know that so far what I'm looking at is size and electronegativity trends, but I could also pull in this resonance and leaving group and other things. So some other really good leaving groups. Are the tosylate families. tosylates are species that are, I don't want to draw it. Let's try it this way. Let me change this around. Tosylates all have the same structure. Actually, I take it back. I'm not going to put this here as an aromatic ring. I'm going to put it as an RO and minus. This is a tosylate, or what is put into the family of tosylates. They're really sulfates, or sulfonates is what they're really called. So we have different leaving groups. The first one is called a tosylate. It's abbreviated with a TS. This is a benzene ring with a methyl group, the sulfur, and the oxygen. And that is a weak base due to the resonance associated with the negative charge being able to resonate to each one of the oxygens. We have a triflate. Triflate is abbreviated TF. In the triflate, it has the same structure for the sulfur, but rather than an aromatic electron stabilizing group, it has a larger electron withdrawing group with CF3 on it, where each one of the fluorides is a highly strong electron withdrawing group. And the last one is a mesylate. MS, not ME. And here again, similar in structure, but we have a CH3 group as the methyl group. And so these are three strong, really good electron withdrawing groups, and I've put them out of order. I should have created the proper order for them. The strongest of those electron withdrawing groups, or the strongest, the best leaving group, is really the triflate, then the tosylate, then the mesylate. So this guy here is the strongest of the family, and this guy is the weakest. But these are all still better than an iodide. So these are all still really good leaving groups. And when we put them onto a molecule to show them as a leaving group on a molecule, we would draw it this way, where we would say OTS, and that would represent this part of the molecule. Actually, that should be OTF, because I switched my organization here. And the oxygen, which is this oxygen, is that one which is touted there. In the same way, this one is OTS, and this one is OMS. And they work exactly the same way. And so when you see these abbreviations are used as abbreviations for good leaving groups. And we will commonly come across those. We'll show you how to make them later, but they're made from alcohols in general. And we'll go through and we'll show you how to make them. All right, so that's the leaving group component. The better leaving group, the faster the reaction. So that gets our leaving group. Let's do temperature for a minute. We'll come back and we'll hit base sort of last. The reason I want to do temperature is related to leaving group. This one is really hard because it's relative. They kind of go together. What is a high temperature and what is a low temperature can be different things at different times. And so I can't give you a temperature of what is high and what is low simply because it's entirely relative to what the LG is, to what the leaving group is. Sometimes 0 degrees C can be high. Sometimes high is refluxing. Sometimes low is 0 degrees C. And sometimes low is minus 32 or minus 178. And so what is high and what is low is entirely relative and is a moving target. So let's take sort of SN1E1 for a minute. And let's think about what has to happen there. In an SN1E1, what has to happen is the leaving group has to break off to become the carbocation and the leaving group. And that bond has to break. We have to have a bond dissociation. The temperature that can cause that bond dissociation is determined by how good the leaving group is. So if I have a leaving group that is a really good leaving group, say a triflate, then this thing might dissociate at minus 30 degrees, and this might be a high temperature. So that's minus 30 degrees C, but change the leaving group. And let's make this leaving group a chloride. And minus 30 degrees now is really a low temperature. So how do I, and I would get no reaction here. So how do I tell when a temperature is high and when a temperature is low? I think about it this way. I think about sort of the, I can do it here next to these guys. I think about this sort of like that paddle game where you have a paddle and that paddle is connecting to some ball and we have a string that connects them. And you are hitting this ball with the paddle and the force with which you hit the ball, the force is proportional to 10. Now, whether the ball and the string breaks, whether the string breaks and the ball comes free, is a matter of how heavy the ball is and how strong the string is. And so the example that I'm doing here with the triflate, I think about this as a ball, which is a pretty heavy ball, and the string is something that is like, thread. All you need to do is just toss that ball and not even really hit it with the paddle, and the string is going to break. So this piece here is just like thin thread. It doesn't take much energy in order to break it. But in the bottom reaction, we've got the same size paddle. We've got the same sort of mechanism going on. But now this thing is connected with chains. And so this is like a link chain. And the ball that's out here is a ping pong ball. You can hit this thing as hard as you want. You can turn that temperature up really high. And it's not going to be able to break because the two are connected so strongly and the leaving group, not a very good leaving group. And so it takes a lot more energy in order to be able to break it. That requiring high energy equals high heat. And so temperature is entirely relative due to what's going on in the reaction and what your actual leaving group is and how stable the carbocation is and all those other factors. So temp, when we talk about temp, temp is proportional, related to stability of carbocation. Stability of leaving group. The solvent, in terms of how the solvent is feeding back into the stability of these things. Temp is entirely relevant to all of those factors and can't easily be nailed down. So how do I know when something is of high temp and when something is of low temp? It's tough. So simple guidelines. What I would say is that when you see this symbol, this equals reflux. And that is reflux in the solvent. And that equals the highest possible temperature you can obtain without putting it under pressure. And so that equals high temp. Actually, I'm going to stick that over here. So that one will be our high temp. What is low temp? In most cases, below 0 degrees or below is considered to be low temp. And I'll say usually low temp because there are certain circumstances where we can find ourselves in situations where 0 degrees is not low. Most of the time when I get down to minus 30 degrees Celsius or minus 78 degrees C, these are low temp. The minus 78, this is dry ice and acetone. And it's used to be able to control highly exothermic reactions. So it's a pretty cold temperature. Minus 30 degrees is another cooling bath. I think this is sodium chloride and ice, which gets us down to minus 30. And that those two temperatures are generally considered to be colder temperatures. And then everything else is kind of up for grabs in terms of in the middle and a little bit harder to deal with. And we're just gonna have to see a lot of examples before we can start to make sense out of that. And so, where was I? Solvent, so all the way back up there already? God, moving fast on this. Okay, so that hits temperature. Base is the last one. How do I know the difference between a base and a nucleophile? This is not easy either. In general, a good nucleophile is a weak base. Also, a good leaving group is a weak base. So that doesn't really help us. What I want to do with bases versus nucleophile is, let's take it down to this. Bulky base, of which there are two. The bulky base is potassium tert-butoxide. Let's do it by words first. Potassium O tertiary butoxide and LDA, lithium diisopropyl amide. These are my two bulky bases. Potassium ion and the tertiary butoxide ion, and LDA, which stands for lithium diisopropyl amide. This one also a bulky base. This has the lithium, a nitrogen, and two isopropyl groups on the nitrogen and the negative charge on the nitrogen. These two are only bases. They are non-nucleophilic. Due to sterics. And so, how do I tell the difference between other bases and nucleophiles? It's complicated and situational. Base-rich nucleophile often depends on other factors going on in the reaction. The other factors that may contribute to this may be things like, is there a carbocation? Meaning, are we doing SM1, E1? Maybe temperature. Is the temp high or low? Can influence whether or not something acts as a base, solvent. Can determine whether something acts as a base or a nucleophile. And so we need to answer some other questions before we start to get into that. So then this leaves me in a sense where I really don't know what to do, because I haven't given you enough information to be able to go through and to rate all these factors. So that means that we need some way of putting all of these factors together in order to make sense out of it. So let me show you what we're going to use to go through and to rank these factors and to come up with some different ideas on how we do these problems. Let me see, how do I get there? I'm gonna go get it. Let me stop the screen share for a second. Let me go into med.study, screen share, we'll bring it back. See if we can get it from here. All right, in chemed.study, if I go to the Chem12A page, and I go to additional resources, and I hit that additional resources link. There's a couple of resources here. The first one is IUPAC, and it is the link to the webpage of IUPAC where they have all the compilation of nomenclature. So that's a really nice one. This other one, the second one down, is called Nucleophilic Substitution and Elimination Guidelines. And these are compiled in part from Carey and Sundberg and their advanced organic chemistry technique or textbook. And what I did is I took a number of tables from them and put them together in order to use as a guidelines to rank things. So when we click on that, you come up with a two-page PDF. The question is, how do we discern when substitution is favored versus elimination? And the answer is found partly in how we should think about reactions of alkyl halides. The characteristic reaction of an alkyl halide or an alkyl tosylate with a Lewis base is elimination. Special conditions are required to promote substitution. So most of the reactions undergo elimination, and special conditions are required in order to do substitution. Here's some guidelines. So I have them broken up into substitution and elimination. SN2 versus E2, SN1 versus E1. And they're broken up by substrate, solvent, nucleophile, leaving group, temperature. SN2 groups, the substrates that promote SN2, are benzyl, allele, methyl, primary, secondary, alpha haloketones, alpha haloesters, alpha halonitriles. We'll have to talk about what those actually look like, what they mean. Solvents, polar, aprotic, will promote SN2. Nucleophiles, good nucleophile, weaker base than hydroxide. Leaving groups, sulfonates are better than iodides, better than bromides, better than chlorides. And temperatures, low. E2, on the other hand, are better on tertiary substrates or secondary and are worse on primary. So they run the opposite in terms of substrate. They want polar aprotic solvents as well because they're both bimolecular. The nucleophile, instead of a nucleophile, what we want is a strong base. We want a bulky base or a strong base. And I quantify that as being a base which is stronger than hydroxide, stronger to or equal to hydroxide. Sulfonates, iodides, bromides, chlorides, in terms of the leaving group. So the stronger the leaving group, the faster the reaction. And for eliminations, they like higher temps as opposed to low temps. All right, now I could go through the SN1 and the E1 as well, but let's put the brakes on that for a minute. Let me show you the second page, because how do I tell whether a base is stronger than hydroxide or not? Or what are my polar aprotic versus polar protic solvents? All of those questions get answered on the second page. So the second page has classifications of nucleophiles. What are very good nucleophiles? Iodides, HS minus, RS minus. What are good nucleophiles? Bromide, hydroxide, RO minus, CN minus, N3 minus. Fair nucleophiles, weak nucleophiles, very weak nucleophiles, all put there in terms of ranking for nucleophiles. Nucleophilicity, what makes a good nucleophile or what makes a base? Actually, I need a pointer for this. So I'm going to move this thing over and I'm going to add it into our notability page. Let's go back into notability where I can use a pointer. All right, so this should be now tagged on the end here. It is indeed. Okay, so we're looking at this nucleophilicity constant page now. And what we have is two different pieces of information. We have the pKa of the conjugate acid, and we have this NCH3I. The NCH3I, what this thing is this is a nucleophilicity constant. And what that is doing is it's telling me that the bigger the number, the better the nucleophile. And that's being measured as that nucleophile coming in and reacting with CH3. I to make nucleophile CH3 and I minus. And so it's telling me about which of these are the best nucleophile. And you can see that they're ordered in terms of their nucleophilicity, so that C6H5S minus is a better nucleophile than CH3O minus, which is what we would expect based on the trend that we looked at before. So then this data here is about acidity. And what you can see is that the pKa, the acidity, does not correlate with nucleophilicity. Nucleophilicity and acidity or basicity are completely different animals and don't correlate. But what I can do is I can use this table for both of these ideas. So if I, by both of these ideas, I mean, I can use this table to figure out my nucleophile and what is a good nucleophile, but I can also figure out whether it's stronger or weaker than hydroxide. So here's how I can do that. Let's say that I want to look at NH2 minus. And I want to know how good a nucleophile that is. Well, I can come in here and I can't find NH2 minus. There's an N3 minus. There's an NH3, but there's no NH2 minus. The closest thing I can find is where the negative charge is on a nitrogen, and I would have to use the cyanide anion. Cyanide anion, this guy, is where the negative charge is on the nitrogen. And that's going to be as close as I can get to NH2. And it tells me a couple of things. It tells me, number one, it's near the bottom of the table and it's at the good nucleophile list. So this would be a good nucleophile. Is it stronger than hydroxide? Well, what I can do is, this is just going to be a rough estimate. I can look at it and say, all right, the pKa of the conjugate is 9.3. And if I go up and I look at hydroxide, the conjugate of hydroxide is 15.7. So hydroxide, in terms of how strong a base it is, remember that basicity goes opposite in terms of conjugates. So if water has a conjugate where its acidity is 15.7, and that is telling me about how strong a base hydroxide is, then any number which is greater than 15.7 is going to give me a basicity greater than hydroxide. So in other words, if I look at it this way, here's hydroxide. And here's water, its conjugate. And here's the pKa of the conjugate. The pKa here is at 15.7. So if I go to something that is like CH3 minus, and this conjugate is CH4, and the pKa is 60, this is going to be stronger base. In fact, that methane anion is going to be an insanely strong base. If I go the other direction and I look at something that is on the order of I minus and its conjugate is IH and its pKa of that conjugate is minus 10.7. And I chose that because I was trying to find something that was the lowest number that I could find on this table. This is an extremely weak base. So as I look at lower numbers on that pKa table, the lower the number on the pKa table, lower than 15.7, is going to be a weaker base than hydroxide. So now we come back to this question here, and I'm looking at this, and this is 9.3. 9.3 is putting me less. 9.3 is putting me less than 15.7. This is going to be a weaker base than hydroxide. And that's how I can use that table to gain both nucleophilicity and also basicity. So that table can be really helpful in terms of trying to figure out whether it's a weaker base or stronger base than hydroxide. And I just have to do it by association. I just have to look and find something similar to what it is that I'm looking for. So if there's different R groups that are attached to it, yes, they're going to affect it. But unless the pKa was really close to hydroxide to begin with, it's not going to affect it enough. So you just sort of use what's close to it. The other tables that are here are some tables on solvents. Solvents which promote SN2 and E2, bimolecular. And these are acetone, dimethyl sulfoxide, and then dimethyl formamide, acetonitrile, hexamethyl phosphoylamide. The abbreviations here are common abbreviations that we use, but we could also do this by structure. Acetone, dimethyl sulfoxide. We can use dimethyl formamide. Acetonitrile is CH3, C triple bonded N. And the hexamethyl phosphoryl amide, you almost never use. And I think that's this one. Phosphor in my P. We have nitrogens. And there are dimethyls on each of these nitrogens. That's the hexamethyl phosphoryl amide. Solvents which promote SM1 and E1. These are our polar protic solvents now. So now we're going into polar protic, ethanol, methanol, aqueous ethanol, water, acetic acid, formic acid, trifluoroethanol, trifluoroacetic acid, trifluoroethanol, CF3CH2OH, and trifluoroacetic acid, CF3, going to the carboxylic group there, is the trifluoroacetic acid. So all of those are solvents which promote SN1, E1. So we've got a lot of different data that's on this table here. And how do we go about using all this data now? Now we need a problem, and now we need to see, how do I go through and actually use this table to figure out what's going to actually happen on a reaction? Let's take a reaction, and let me just run through a quick run through on the table, and then next class, all about examples. So let me take and let's take a reaction and see what happens. This is a reaction that has a stereocenter in it. And we are reacting it with sodium azide. It's being done in acetone. And it's being done at 30 degrees C. Okay, and so the question now is, what happens? Is it an E1? Is it an SN1? Is it an E2? Is it an SN2? Well, we've got to go through and we've got to rank everything. So the first thing that we have here is we have the substrate. We've got to figure out what degree the substrate is. Is it primary, secondary, tertiary, or is it other? Is it some other sort of substrate that I've got to worry about? Well, in order to know what substrate it is, I first have to identify what the leaving group is. So there are a couple of different groups here, but in terms of leaving groups, we've talked about one of these in particular being a certain type of leaving group, and that's the tosylate. So the leaving group is sitting here. Leaving group equals OTS. And that leaving group then defines the position on which I need to rank the substrate. So the substrate, when I look at it, it's 1, 2, this looks like it's a secondary substrate, but maybe ranked slightly differently depending upon what's going on here. So this group is a benzyl group, and this is a secondary benzylic leaving group. So there's my substrate. That's how my substrate ranks out. My leaving group, well, I haven't ranked it yet. I've just identified it. What is my nucleophile? This guy here, N3 minus, is the nucleophile. I'll have to go get information on that. Acetone is my solvent. And then finally, we've got the temperature. I need a new color. So let's go back to the chart. Let's look up that OTS real quick. OTS in terms of leaving groups. Got to go all the way back up here. Leaving groups, sulfonates are the best leaving group in every category, and doesn't determine which direction directly a reaction goes, but it's a really good leaving group. So my sulfonate up here is a really good leaving group, which means it's going to come off at fairly low temperature. That's that first part. Substrate, secondary substrates can be problematic because they can go SN1, SN2, E1, E2, they can go any direction they want. But we're a secondary benzylic. So let's go look. Substrates, benzyl, benzylic, is one, and allylic are even better than methyl. We're not tertiary. We're not tertiary. We're not tertiary. We're in this benzylic area here. This is really promoting an SN2 reaction. So when I come back here and I see that benzylic substrate, this is pointing me towards SN2. Now let's go look at the nucleophile and see what the nucleophile is pointing me towards. The nucleophile is an N3 minus. It's here in the good nucleophiles. When I look up here and I see what does nucleophilic need to be, for SN2, it needs to be a good nucleophile, weaker base than hydroxide. If I'm going elimination, it needs to be a stronger base than hydroxide. How does this thing rank out? Well, fortunately, we were kind of looking at that already. If I'm looking at an N minus, which is similar to this one, we're looking at something similar to the CN minus. That was already determined to be a weaker base than hydroxide. So this is a good nucleophile. And it's weaker than hydroxide. And because of that, this is also good for SN2. Is it good for anything else? Let's see. We need stronger base. Nope, so it's not the E2. Weak nucleophile, no anions. Nope, this is definitely an anion. Any anionic base can go E1. So this could go E1 as well and has the possibility of SN2 or E1. My solvent, acetone, I'll draw the structure. Acetone is that structure. We go up and we see what list it's in. Acetone here is at the top of the solvents which promote SN2 and E2 bimolecular reactions. It is a polar aprotic solvent. So this is polar aprotic and really likes to go SN2 or E2, the bimolecular reactions. My temp, in that I've got a really good leaving group, this is a fairly high temp, but it's not a refluxing temp. So this is sort of like middle of the road and isn't really telling me much. I wouldn't consider it high. It's not refluxing, but it's not giving me a whole lot of information. So what do I see here? What I see is that when I go through and look at the majority of what things are pointing towards, I see SN2. I see SN2. I see SN2. I see SN2 coming up a lot of times. I see E1 and E2, but they're only coming up once. This is really pointing towards an SN2 reaction. And because of that, I'm going to say that my SN2 is going to be major. And so now I need to draw out the reaction and draw the SN2 product. Yeah, that was the proton that was there. This was the OTS, the rest of that molecule that's going on. And so I'm going to do a backside attack by the azide, kicking out the OTS following my SN2 mechanism. And I'm going to invert that stereocenter. Now, how I invert it is kind of up to me, but I need to invert the stereocenter. So there's a couple of different ways I could draw it. One way I could draw it is to bring in that nitrogen there and to push back the hydrogen, leave that other group attached and bring in the azide. And I need to decide on what direction that azide is going. I think it's going to be in that direction. I don't know that I'm comfortable in drawing that way. The better way to draw it would be to do it this way. Invert the stereo center and change the stereochemistry, keeping everything else the same. So that what I would do is I would make the hydrogen forward and the N3 group backwards. And that this is the better sort of representation of the way to draw it. And that would be the major SN2 product. Okay, so I'm running a little over time for this lecture. I'm going to cut it at this. I'll open it up for questions and see if there's any questions. But the main thing here is that what we're going to do is we're going to go through a large number of examples. And we're going to use that, for lack of a better term, the magic sheet. That's what students have decided to call this over the years. I didn't title it that. The students sort of titled it that. So this is the magic sheet. Come on, AKA magic sheet. And we're going to use the magic sheet as a guide to try to gain familiarization with the different factors that are playing into these chemical reactions and to try to gauge what the major reaction is going to be and then the major product. And that's how we're going to decide whether it goes E1, E2, SN2, or I lost the last one, whatever the last one is. And it's just going to take a bunch of practice. And I cannot encourage you enough to just do a ton of these. It just takes a lot of practice. And I have a co-op up that I'll set for you guys as well that will get you guys practicing these and using the magic sheet to go through and to look at how these factors relate. All right, that's it for today. I'm going to cut it. I'll get this up and posted. And I'll see you guys next week. All right. Thanks a lot. All right.